Well, to go or not to go into space, that's the question. Up next, Howard Bloom, James McKenney, and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to take your phone calls right here with our friends James McKenney and Howard Bloom. The Diamond Principle. James, you have talked about how the sun contributes to the creation of diamonds and how interesting the sun contributes to the creation of just about everything.
Well, the electric fields are key to so many things. Let's give another example. Weather on Earth, if we didn't have the electric fields that drive the weather systems from above, from the ionosphere, we would have very bland weather. We would have just mild breezes that blew around the Earth. We would not have the cumulonimbus clouds that build in the vertical electric field. We wouldn't have much of the weather we see today. There's an interesting example relative to diamonds, and we find pure diamonds in outer space. One of the examples, the mastodons, when they went down, some of them have been pulverized with just like shotgun blasts of micro diamonds, pure little diamonds that came in, and the only place they could come from was outer space. There are stars that have belts of diamonds around them. They're X-ray stars, and they have so many diamonds around them that the diamonds are visible from outer, from Earth, that we can see the belts of diamonds. And so once again, it's very clear that diamonds are not made deep in the earth, as we're always told. There's some interesting anecdotes about diamonds that come out of the earth. It's said they're made under tremendous pressure billions of years ago, but they're usually found in soft coal. So how did you get the tremendous pressure onto these diamonds as they were forming? There's so many contradictions in the standard story of where diamonds come from. The one that makes sense is that they came from outer space, from the nose side of these tremendously powerful comets, in the electrical discharges with carbon gases present. And that's the same formative process that forms the hydrocarbons, that forms water, that forms the nucleotides of DNA, which have been found in space, the Genesis probe that went out to Comet Vild, I believe it was, went through the tail of the comet and picked up nucleotides, the DNA nucleotides. So these chemicals form in outer space, and then as we move through these comet tails, the big ones, we pick up this material, including the diamonds.
You have your own theories, Howard, on diamonds and oil.
Well, it's not so much on diamonds and oil. You know, there's the work of Thomas Gold, and it's been supported by Lynn Margulis, and it's one that Jim has talked about in his work but doesn't really support, and that's the abiotic theory of oil. And the abiotic theory of oil says, look, there are hydrocarbons. There are carbon-based molecules all over the universe. We see them in hot clouds of gas. We see them in cold interstellar clouds of gas. They're all, it's remarkable we see them in so many different places. And the idea that I believe Gold is proposing is that a whole mess of those got crunched into the earth when the earth was crunched together like a big ball of paper 4.5 billion years ago, 4.6 billion years ago, and that we didn't have, as Jim says, we did not have dinosaurs dying in the La Brea tar pits and turning into oil. What we had are these massive amount of carbon-based biomolecules that were crunched in the bowels of the earth, and that means there's a very important implication to that, and it is there is no peak oil, that the amount of oil in this earth is so vast that we will never run out of this stuff. Now, I don't know enough to either support or oppose that theory, but Lynn Margulis is a National Medal of Science winner, and she is one of the most important biologists of the late 20th century, and she endorses it completely. Jim, you have an opinion on that, too.
Well, here's what I've learned in my wisdom in my older ages, is that there can be numerous processes. And what contributes, let's take a look at asteroids, for example. It's pretty clear that some of the asteroids probably came from exploded things. And they're starting to actually, I was at a American Geophysical Union meeting about a couple of years ago, and there were some Russian scientists that were working with some American data, some of the old data, And they could actually piece together how some of these rocks spectroscopically fit with other ones. And so they were showing that these associated asteroids out there in the asteroid belt actually came from something bigger. And then you have the situation where you have some asteroid moons around Saturn, which are clearly captured. So they probably came in from way outside the solar system and were captured. So you have multiple processes forming the asteroids, for example. So there's no one process that you can say that's what happened to all of these.
No, I agree with you. There are a lot of processes that can happen simultaneously. And there's a paper that I presented at the Human Behavior and Evolution Society back in 1995, and it brought up something called supersynchrony and supersimultaneity. It's a paper that's up on my website, howardbloom.net. And it basically points out that we were just talking about carbon molecules, carbon-based molecules, biomolecules showing up all over the cosmos. And they all apparently showed up pretty much the same time. So even though, George, you know that I'm a great skeptic about there being life on any other planet but this one, because this is the only one on which we've got evidence for life. But the fact is that this concept of supersynchrony and supersimultaneity, that the same things tend to happen for the same reasons all over the cosmos pretty much at the same time, the way hundreds and hundreds of billions of stars all formed and all have pretty much the same shape. They're all big round balls that are collapsing massive amounts of atoms in their core and then crunching them together in order to make light. It's the same thing no matter where you look in the cosmos. Well, in the same way that we had billions upon billions of stars forming in pretty much the same way all over the place, it is entirely conceivable that we've had life forming all over the place.
I remember the program, Howard. I almost had you convinced there was a God.
Yes, you work on that very hard,
yeah,
George.
Let's take some calls here. First-time caller, we've got Alan in Pleasant Point, Maine. You're up with us. Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
I think that there's going to be only one way for people to colonize in space, and we're talking about moving, you know, $14,000 per pound to move the people that are already here. I think the only way is that we're going to have to just bring embryos and perhaps cloning and stuff like that, you know, for the amount of time and the amount of distance that needs to be traveled. We've got to stop thinking about, you know, moving the people that are already here.
And it's a good idea, but there's a problem, and Jim probably knows more about this than I do, but there is a doctor at NASA who will give you a lecture anytime you approach him about giving birth in space. And if you don't have gravity, an embryo doesn't develop. It just kills itself off. So in order to have, in order to give birth to embryos by test tube means or in the wombs of women in space, you've got to have artificial gravity.
One of the ideas that I bring out in the Diamond Principle is that nature has provided us with very, very elegant but very simple ways of doing things. And there's actually a lift system that's an electromagnetic propulsion system. And here's how it works. George asked me earlier about the elevator, which is a string that goes up into space with a tether. But if you discharge the vertical electric field and get an electric current coming down, you can ride the magnetic field up with a spacecraft that's properly designed. And so these are electromagnetic propulsion systems. There's no fuel involved. One of the big reasons for the tremendous cost of getting into space is because you have the fuel, you have to put it together, you have to pressurize it, you have this big tank, and you have all of this complicated machinery, whereas with the electromagnetic propulsion systems, you don't have any of that.
Does it involve having a tether? Because you told George earlier that a tether was impossible.
No, it does not. You basically discharge the vertical electric field, which is there's a mechanism for doing that, and that's what Tesla was doing with his tower. You run it at about a 40 hertz frequency, and what it does is it flips the ions back and forth. And it takes a lot of power. You're basically drilling an electrical hole through the atmosphere, which is a dielectric, and as you get the molecules flipping in unison at about 40 cycles per second, basically you're controlling the molecules, and as this generates moves upwards and penetrates through the atmosphere, finally it hits the ionosphere And all of that charge comes draining down. So, but you have to control it. You just can't drain the whole thing. But the point is you can get a column of electricity draining from the ionosphere down to ground. It's that column of electricity that you ride up. So it's a tether of electricity, but there is no string or tether. And you literally ride the electric, the magnetic field upwards with a properly designed tube system.
How do you keep it from being dangerous?
you have to be very careful. And that's one of the things that once the currents start draining down, it's kind of like a tributary of rivers. It's pulling from all localized regions above you. And you have to, it's like a dam. You don't let all the water out at once. You do it under control, and you only let a certain amount of water out at the time. That's what you use to generate power.
And what do you see as the way to generate gravity?
What's that?
What do you see as the way to generate gravity once we've got colonies up there?
Just spinning wheels.
Yeah, okay, so we're both on centrifugal force.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That's the. If there's another way, I don't know about it, but the very simple, straightforward way, just the spinning wheel, and it works every time.
Let's go on the international line. Gene Lacombe, Alberta in Canada. Go ahead, Gene.
Hello there.
Hi.
Dr. McKinney, are you familiar with David Serrata's work?
Well, we all are, of course. David Serrata, a regular guest on Coast to Coast. But
yeah,
go ahead,
you
Gene.
Are, George. Yeah,
be a little more specific, though, with the question.
Oh, okay. He does a lot of work with zero-point energy. He's written a book, I think, called Differentials of Harmonic Codes, where he talks about, you know, kind of like magic numbers, so to speak, rational numbers, which he uses to work. Are you familiar with any of that?
Not offhand, no. No.
You should hook up, because he's, I'm not sure if you're talking about zero-point energy or kind of angle on it, or...
No, not at all. The whole concept is that the sun, the fusion of the sun produces a solar wind. Traditional science believes that the solar wind is neutral, and what I've shown is that there's an excess of protons in that solar wind, and that develops a current cycle in the solar system. And there's a capacitor that's built up, and all of the planets, comets, anything in outer space, dust particles, all discharge that solar capacitor. And what happens when you discharge that solar capacitor, currents flow, for one, and also the objects become slightly negatively charged, which means they draw in material. Anything that's positively charged, they draw in material, and because the electrons have a higher mobility, the objects tend to maintain a negative charge, and that negative charge is draining out from the sun. And like I say, there's a very good example, the bug killer, the bug zapper, which does it, and everybody has seen those. And what happens is the bug flies into the grid, into the potential electric field, and all of the current drains along the bug, and I call it the comet effect. But at any rate, that also powers our, provides a current or a charge in our ionosphere, which gives us the vertical electric field, which you can walk outside and measure. Just take a big loop of wire and run it up into the air, and you will be able to measure the vertical electric field. You won't get much current from it, because the air is a dielectric and it blocks that current from coming down. That's why you have to drill through that dielectric to get up to the ionosphere to start draining that power down in to the Earth. Weather systems do it naturally. When the cloud systems build up, it's like a finger pointing up, and it drains that energy down, and that's what powers the electrical conditions and cyclonic storms and hurricanes. But the point is that, no, I'm not talking about zero-point energy. I'm talking about a very specific electrical energy source that powers the solar system, and we can tap into that.
What did you mean, Howard, by dipoles?
Well, the dipole concept, which Jim uses, means basically that you've got a whole bunch of protons at one end of a wire, and you've got a whole bunch of electrons at the other end of the wire, and the electrons need to rush into the arms of the protons, so they go rushing down the wire, and that's called an electrical current. And you have that when you, I mean, Jim understands this stuff much better than I do and could probably give a much better explanation. But when you put a huge antenna out in your backyard for a ham radio or for a crystal radio, you're taking advantage of the fact that there's a dipole effect. And Jim, you know how it works. I don't quite know how it works. But you're also taking advantage of the fact that if you have an electromagnetic wave moving across a wire, it produces a tiny trickle of electricity. And that I think is part of the phenomena that Jim is talking about. Space is just filled with electromagnetic waves. You must have done the experiment at one time or another where you take a magnet and you put a piece of paper on it and you shake metal filings on it.
And it takes the filings line up, the little long filings take the direction of the magnetic field, and so you literally see the magnetic field.
Right, and so they make loops within loops within loops within
right.
loops. Well, if you move a conductor through those loops, it generates electricity in the wire. And so when Jim is talking about moving anything through space, you're moving through loop after loop after loop of magnetic current, and every time you cross one of those electric currents and go from its peak to its trough, you should be generating electricity, Jim. Am I right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, the plasma interactions are very complex out there, and so you have the ultimate generator in the fusion of the sun, which separates charge, and that's where they see the coronal holes opening up. You have the corona of relativistic electrons around the sun. There's no known mechanism to hold those electrons in place except for the fact that the surface of the sun has a positive charge.
Well, there's one other thing, and I don't know if I can put it in a way that doesn't put the audience to sleep, but we've just seemingly discovered, we're not sure of it yet, that the fine structure constant of the universe is greater in one direction and it's less in another direction. It's supposed to be uniform throughout the entire universe, and it's not. And the people who are describing this, the astrophysicists who are describing this, say that the universe looks like a dipole because it's got more stuff on one end than it has on the other, and that stuff is draining in one direction, just like the currents of electricity draining through a copper coil or any other or copper cable or any kind of conductor that Jim is talking about.
Yeah, there was an interesting event back in the 90s, and there came out of some military studies, but one day Earth got hit with a tremendous electron beam. And so they studied what they could get data from the various satellites, and they realized it came from Jupiter. Basically what happens is Jupiter, like Earth, like everything, is discharging the solar capacitor. And it, on the nose side and the sunward side is an electron current, the dominant charge carrier. And like you were saying, if you have a pool of ions or protons over here, those electrons are going to want to move very quickly. And so all of the planets have this. Well, we connected into the electron beam on the nose side of Jupiter one day, and we got quite a jolt. But anyway, it's things like that they're going on in outer space. Interesting sideline here. When I was back in the mid-90s, I was working with some Russian scientists, and they were looking at my work. And at the same university were some psychologists who were trying to understand astrology. Why would the planets aligning and doing these strange configurations cause an effect on humans? Well, as it turns out, it's the electric currents that link up when these configurations occur. And we can sense that.
All right. Well, you two stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment with final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're waiting on a confirmation for tomorrow to see if Eric Von Daniken is available to do a full show. So we've been waiting on him. We'll find out. If not, we'll have something else for you on Coast to Coast AM. When we come back, let's take some final phone calls with the Professor James McCanney and Howard Bloom on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Howard Bloom, James McCanney. Howard, is it our right? Is it our right to go out into space?
It's our obligation. It's our obligation. Well, you know what I'm about to say. It's our obligation on behalf of all life. It's our obligation on behalf of nature. It's our obligation on behalf of everything green. It's our obligation on behalf of a 4-billion-year project whose legacy or whose future is in our hands. So I can't see any sense in which it would. George, how could it not be our right? What could be telling us that it would be desecrating space? I mean, desecrating great globs of nothing but empty rock. Those globs of empty rock are waiting for the same things that this Earth has been waiting for, and that is to be turned green, at least in my humble opinion.
Yeah. How about you, James?
I think we have to do it responsibly. And I also am an advocate that we cannot take our current economic models into space. Howard was talking about the resources we have, but we see those resources in this country. I go to many third world countries. Believe me, they don't have resources there. They don't have anything in a lot of these places. So what we've got to learn is to distribute what we have equally. And like I say, I'm not talking socialism. We have to learn that the poorest person in the society is an indicator of the society. If we have lots over here and that guy over there has nothing and he's crawling in the dirt and we're taking resources out of his country so we have more here, that economic model is a failure. Because we can't take that model into outer space, is what I'm saying. We have to have a different economic model and a different social model. So, and that's one of the points of the Diamond Principle, is that we have a lot of house cleaning to do before we start sending large populations in space, because if there are aliens out there watching us, they're not going to let us out there with our current mode of operation.
I don't blame them. Let's go to John in San Diego. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say that you guys are really smart and having an interesting topic. I'm actually a first-time caller. I have a comment and I have a question that I want to add.
Sure.
My first comment is, I'm an inventor. I had figured it out on two ways of propulsion. I'm just very keeping this a secret. We already have anti-gravity machines. You can go into any book and look at it, but it's not that of it that way. And I also have, I know it's similar to the Hutchinson effect. I have, instead of making metallic things flow, I can even make people flow and rocks flow, which is very different from anti-gravity. And I know that could be used for going into space. Like I said, I want to work for the government. Hopefully my dream is to work for Area 51. But
let me tell you something, John. If you can do this, you probably won't have any problem getting a job at all. What do you think of anti-gravity devices, James?
Well, gravity is an interesting force. It goes through magnetic fields, electric fields. Our satellites work wonderfully well in orbit around Earth, and we have all kinds of electromagnetic things between them. So gravity is it works through other objects that are massive. Gravity is an interesting force. So when you say anti-gravity, what it says to me is you create a different kind of force to oppose gravity. And, for example, the electromagnetic propulsion systems, one could call them anti-gravity in that they oppose gravity's force. They don't change gravity. It's just another type of force that you use, like a chemical rocket is an anti-gravity machine in a sense, because it opposes gravity. It goes in the other direction, but it uses a force, it uses an energy source, and that's what the electromagnetic propulsion systems do.
What's the difference between true science and real science? Anyone?
Jim, you have tier one science and tier two science. You're the expert on this.
Well, science, there's too many opinions floating around today. And so let's get back to what science really is. Science is a methodology. And you propose something, and then you propose experiments. So if you propose something, but you can't propose an experiment and then perform that experiment and get results, and then have a guy over there in another country, a third-party independent person, do the same experiment and get that, that's what the Fleischmann thing was all about. They did something, and they published their results, but they didn't have the third-party verification.
Yeah, that's cold fusion.
Yeah, and so the issue with science is the methodology. It's verifiable, Here, me, I do it, I can do it. In Russia, they can do it and verify exactly the same thing, measuring within limits. So that's science. And too many times, and unfortunately in space science today, we get data in, it's interpreted in terms of theories. And so a lot of times those theories are proposed by people who have an agenda to maintain those theories because that's their livelihood. So science is it's kind of a nebulous term, but there's well-established science like gravity in the inverse square law, for example, of gravity or electric field. But then there are things today which are not so well-established and I think more political. So science has to be a methodology that's independent, objective, and verifiable by third parties. So that's my...
Well, I have a question that relates to this, and that is, you heard me talk about what I think is nature's imperative to us, nature's absolute order for us to use our skills to get beyond the atmosphere and get out of the gravity well and take ecosystems into outer space and to other planets and to green the universe. But you also have an idea of what nature's imperative is. You also have an idea of the proper way to read our destiny. So I'm very curious about what it is.
It's very similar, but I think we have to do it responsibly. And if we don't, sooner or later, we're going to meet up with somebody out there that doesn't like what we're doing. For example, taking our petty Earth wars into outer space. For example, right now we have a little contest going with China where they're developing anti-satellite devices. We're putting satellites into space. We call them, we don't call them military, but none of our military equipment will work without GPS.
Right.
So how do you, you know, is that the GPS satellites? And they can turn those off so your GPS device doesn't work someday and only the military ones work. So these are military devices.
Security is a very common concept in the military field. So it tells you that, yes, we are prepared for, we know we've got serious competition in space, and we know that it could turn violent at some point. But, Jim, if we wait forever, if we wait until we have created an ideal social system or until we've changed our social system to get into space, I think we'll be making a huge mistake. It's like, when we had the ability to build a transcontinental railroad, if we had said, well, we have to learn to be a peaceful species, and as a consequence, we have to get well beyond having civil wars. Well, the transcontinental railroad system was built in the wake of the Civil War. Humans have to advance, no matter how primitive our social systems are.
Howard, I think space is different because that's the final frontier. Once we get out there, we're on an infinite trip with our species. And we don't want to take our earthly petty ways out there. So I think it's a little different than building a railroad in that sense. And also, I talk about what I call bubble societies in the book, or splinter societies. And so I think in that sense, we don't have, and we probably won't take everybody. We're not going to take all the people in China and India into space. But what we have to do is develop a certain core group who understands responsibility, personal responsibility as a way of life instead of the rule of law and order, which is more like the law of the jungle with police forces. That's what we live in today.
So we tend to disagree on this. Because first of all, life has been an enormously cooperative enterprise. Again, you go back to the bacterial colonies that are our foremothers and our forefathers. 6 trillion bacteria all cooperating, all exchanging information all of the time, all working together. That is an enormously cooperative enterprise. So when we carry our legacy into space, there's going to be a huge amount of cooperation. But there's also going to be an element of competition, and some of that competition is extremely fruitful. It's what drives the evolutionary process. But I'm with you. I don't want to take these violent tendencies into space, but the one thing that I read from history is that every time we get into a new frontier and every time we open a whole new resource base, we change the nature of human nature. We did that when we sent colonies of Englishmen who were, believe me, no better than the other Englishmen that they left behind, or not much better, over to North America. The first colonies were from the Puritans, and you would think, well, they must be idealistic and they must be righteous and holy. But in fact, it was the Puritans who made the Civil War in England that killed tens of thousands of Englishmen in 1648.
And despite the fact that they were no better than their Puritan brethren, the circumstances of living here in North America changed them, and changed them to the extent that they could come up with a constitution that was beyond anything that humans had previously dreamed. So it's worthwhile to take ourselves with all of our evils into new environments to the best extent, to the best extent that we can, because in those new environments we grow and we develop new social tools and we become new social beings.
Well, you're probably right in that if we wait, we won't ever go there.
Right.
All right, let's go to final calls. We'll go to Jeff in Altaloma, California. Go ahead, Jeff. Thanks for holding.
Hey, how you doing this evening?
Okay.
I was reading Dune while you guys were talking, which is talks about spreading the human species throughout the galaxy. But I had a question. I'm an architect, and I was interested in there's a book by Arthur C. Clarke, 3001, where there's a geocentric structure above the Earth with four towers or elevators, and I can visualize it as an architect, but I can't really engineer it. I wonder if your scientist could comment on that.
All right, which one wants it? James, you want to try that?
Well, no, we're talking the elevator again, which was originally an Arthur C. Clarke issue. But okay, let's take the skater. Take a simple example. The skater does a spin, holds his arms out or her arms out, and they pull them in and they spin faster, okay? As you move your arms back out, what happens? You start to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, take as something that's going to go up your elevator way up into space. This is not 10 floors. This is 150 miles. As it goes up, it's going to fall backwards because of the same principle as the skater. It's an angular momentum thing. It's a celestial mechanics thing. And so anyway, what's going to happen is as this thing goes up the elevator, it's going to pull sideways on your elevator, and your elevator will not be able to withstand the forces once this thing goes up. The faster it goes up, the bigger the sideways force. So you're going to have to provide a force in the other direction to keep this thing from pulling your elevator down. Now you have to add fuel. Where are you going to get the fuel? Now you got to carry fuel up your elevator, and it's simply not going to work. And this is something that nobody has considered. You can run a elevator up 100 feet, but try it 150 miles sometime, it'll fail.
Well, let me throw another perspective into this, and that is economies depend on an infrastructure, and that includes railroads and highways and buildings and bridges and all kinds of stuff. But in the future, we're going to depend not just on an infrastructure, but on an exostructure. We are going to build a carapace. We are going to build a shell, like the shell around a snail, or like the exoskeleton on an insect. We're going to build it out in space, and it is going to become the basis for a new economy. Hundreds of thousands and eventually millions of people will live up there. We will not have to depend on the resources of the Earth anymore. We won't have to suck oil out of the ground. We won't have to have BP oil spills, because the resources available from one asteroid would be worth between $1 trillion and $17 trillion. That's worth between the gross domestic product of Korea at $1 trillion or the gross domestic product of the United States at $17 trillion. We will no longer have to depend on Earth for energy, because the solar power available in space is endless. And we will no longer have to depend on Earth for building materials, just as Jim has said, because we'll pull them from the moon and we'll pull them from asteroids. And the result will be we'll take life to an entirely different level. And there will be out in space, not creating any shadows on the face of the Earth by any stretch of the imagination, but there will be the equivalent of an eighth continent, and it will be surrounding us in a shell so tiny from Earth that we can't see it, but so substantial in what it does to change human history that it utterly defies belief.
All right, let's go to David in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. First-time caller. Go ahead, David.
Dr. Bloom, Mr. Norrie. This question is actually for Dr. McKenna.
McKinney.
That's okay. I am a disenchanted engineer who left the Space Advocate movement in 2001 to ride a bicycle across South and Central America. I believe I encountered something very similar to your pyramid theorem on the gate of the son of Tiwanaku. Allow me to explain. I met a believing computer scientist named Javier Amaruiz Garcia down there, who spent 9 years studying the gate of the sun. He applied something called tetralectic, which is a type of postmodern logic based off of a tetrahedron, which is very similar to your pyramid. And what he found was that off the gate of the sun, he was able to derive mathematically, symbolically, he was able to derive the Ramanujan equations for hyperdimensional physics. He was able to derive phi, the golden ratio. He was able to derive pi. Now, that's all cool and stuff, but what he was really incredible, when I met him down in Santa Cruz, Bolivia, I wrote a book about this, by the way. This expedition almost killed me in the process. He took these equations and he plugged it into a computer and he calculated prime numbers in a very elegant algorithm. And I think you know this, Dr. McKinney, that when you try to calculate if a number is prime up to, say, the millionth or 2 millionth place, that's really difficult. His background is in computer systems engineering. He used to work in Silicon Valley. That his area is in testing CPUs and algorithms in this area. And I wanted to bring this out into your discourse to see, have you considered tetralectics as a possible application? And the other question I had for you was, I almost died.
Just have time for one, because the clock is right here. James, I don't know. Can you?
Well, I believe that the ancients knew a lot of what we're seeing in the ancient, like the pyramids, those are civilizations that came after civilizations that were very advanced but went under during a major catastrophe.
Something happened.
Something happened. We really don't know what. I have some ideas. Other people have ideas. But I wanted to get back to what Howard was saying. I wanted to throw this in, that what we need is a train, basically a space train that orbits from Earth around the moon. It doesn't land on the moon. It just is continually cycling, and when you want to go around to the moon, or you could just take a ride around the moon and come back. And
Jim, that's called the Aldrin Cycler. It's an idea that Buzz Aldrin has been pushing within
the
space
community.
That's right.
He talked about it when you had him on the show a few months ago, Howard.
So you're in good company with that one, and I'm behind you, too.
Gentlemen, we are out of time. I want to thank James McKinney. His latest work is called The Diamond Principle, and, of course, Howard Bloom. Always a great mind. His latest work, The Genius of the Beast. Both of them just tremendous contributors here always to Coast AM. Stick with us for our next program. As a matter of fact, we've got a whole week of great shows for you. So just sit back and relax. Or if you happen to drive, don't relax too much. You better stay alert. Email me, george@coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.